Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Deference and Agency Jurisdiction Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 16, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in City of Arlington v. FCC. The case considers whether a court should give so-called Chevron deference to a government agency's determination regarding its own jurisdiction. To discuss the case, we have Emily Bremer, who is an attorney advisor to the Administrative Conference of the United States. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Bremer.
The case we're discussing today is City of Arlington, Texas versus Federal Communications Commission, number 11-1545. The question presented in this case is one that has long been debated in administrative law scholarship, that is, whether an agency's determination of its own jurisdiction is entitled to Chevron deference. Now, before I get to a discussion of the briefing and argument in this case, I'd like to provide a little bit of background. This case is really about the analytical framework that was established by the Supreme Court in 1984 in the case of Chevron USA versus Natural Resources Defense Council, 467 U.S. 837. This case established the standard for judicial review of an administrative agency's interpretation of a statute that it is charged with implementing. Under Chevron, courts employ a two-step inquiry to evaluate such agency legal interpretations. At step one, the court asks whether the statute provides an unambiguous answer to the legal question that is in dispute. If so, the inquiry ends there, because both the agency and the court are obligated to give effect to Congress's unambiguously expressed intent. But if, however, that statute is ambiguous, then the question is whether or not the agency's interpretation is reasonable. This is so-called step two of the Chevron inquiry. If the agency has come across a permissible interpretation of a statute, then the court is required to defer to it. At base, Chevron is about the separation of powers and the proper allocation of authority among Congress, the courts, and administrative agencies. It recognizes that the Constitution vests legislative authority in Congress, and at the same time recognizes that Congress may implicitly delegate legislative authority by leaving statutory gaps for an administrative agency to fill with its own expert policy judgments. The approach acknowledges that expert agencies are controlled by the political branches and are typically better positioned than unelected federal judges to make the policy judgments that are required in modern regulation. Now, the underlying merits dispute I'm going to discuss in some detail, even though, as I'll explain further on, it's not really at issue, but it involves the FCC's so-called shot clock order. This order interprets 47 U.S.C. section 332(c)(7), a provision of the Communications Act that was added to the statute as part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. This statute implements a distinctive federal telecommunications policy that was pro-competitive, deregulatory, and generally designed to promote the development of a nationwide wireless communication system. But at the same time, wireless networks of this ilk require the construction of thousands of wireless towers and other facilities. And while everyone wants wireless service, these towers and facilities are generally susceptible to the NIMBY problem. That is, no one wants them in my backyard. Now, Section 332(c)(7) of the Telecommunications Act strikes a compromise between federal telecommunications policy on the one hand, and on the other hand, the state and local government's traditional interest and role in regulating zoning and land use. Now, the statute begins with subsection A, which is referred to in the briefing in this case as a savings clause. It states that, except as provided in this paragraph, nothing in this chapter shall limit or affect the authority of a state or local government over decisions regarding the placement, construction, and modification of personal wireless service facilities. The next provision, Section 332(c)(7b), imposes several limitations on state and local zoning authority. The second of these requires state and local governments act on any request for authorization to put up wireless service facilities, to act on that within a reasonable period of time, taking into account the nature and scope of the request. Another provision, Section 332(c)(7b)(4), prevents state and local governments from regulating wireless service facilities on the basis of the environmental effects of radio frequency emissions. This basically gives to the FCC exclusive authority to regulate RF emissions. Now, finally, Section 332C7B5 splits two remedies or forums for parties to challenge local zoning decisions. It provides first that any person adversely affected by a final action or failure to act by a state or local government may, within 30 days after such action or failure to act, commence an action in any court of competent jurisdiction. On the other hand, if a person is adversely affected by state or local regulation in violation of the provision that prevents regulation on the basis of RF emissions, it provides that that party should go to the FCC and petition the commission for relief instead. Now, in 2008, CTA, the Wireless Association, petitioned the FCC for a declaratory ruling to establish more concrete deadlines for state and local zoning decisions. In effect, the petition asked the FCC to issue a binding interpretation of what would constitute a reasonable time for zoning decisions under Section 332C7B2. In 2009, the FCC responded with the shot clock order, which establishes rebuttable presumptions regarding what constitutes a reasonable time for wireless permitting decisions. Now, this decision was based on an extensive factual record that the FCC collected through the proceeding that looked at state and local zoning practices and the experience of wireless carriers in localities around the country. The order began, however, with an FCC's determination that it had the authority to interpret Section 337. That is, its determination that it had the authority to issue binding order interpreting Section 337. On judicial review, the Fifth Circuit upheld the shot clock order, and it reviewed the FCC's determination of this threshold question of its authority to interpret Section 337 under the permissive framework of Chevron. Now, in a very real sense, this case is not actually about Section 337, the scope of the FCC's particular authority to interpret that provision, or the substantive validity of the shot clock order. Indeed, the odd thing about this case is that the Supreme Court granted certiorari only on what is best described as the meta question presented in the case. Namely, did the Fifth Circuit err in according Chevron deference to the FCC's threshold determination that it has the authority, or in the parlance of this case, the jurisdiction, to issue a binding interpretation of Section 337? If the petitioners prevail, the Fifth Circuit's decision would be vacated and remanded. On remand, however, the Fifth Circuit would be called upon to answer the same question, but to reevaluate that threshold question de novo without considering or deferring to the FCC's view that it has the jurisdiction to interpret Section 337 in a binding order. Now, Tom Goldstein, counsel for petitioner City of Arlington, argued on behalf of all petitioners, and he began his oral argument with the inescapable truth that this case becomes very complex very quickly. And the source of this complexity is the difficulty of defining what jurisdiction means in this context and identifying a standard that clearly separates the jurisdictional issue from the sort of general statutory interpretation question that courts routinely address at Chevron Step 1. Petitioner City of Arlington offered a somewhat narrow concept of jurisdiction, which it referred to more particularly as interpretive jurisdiction. Under this account, interpretive jurisdiction refers only to an agency's authority to issue a binding interpretation of a particular statutory provision. In contrast, another group of petitioners, led by the International Municipal Lawyers Association, or IMLA, and represented by former Solicitor General Paul Clement, offered in its brief a far broader definition of jurisdiction. In contrast, another group of petitioners, led by the International Municipal Lawyers Association, or IMLA, and represented by former Solicitor General Paul Clement, offered in its brief a far broader definition of jurisdiction. Under IMLA's approach, jurisdictional issues include any question concerning the who, what, where, and when of regulatory power, that is, which subject matter an agency may regulate, and under what conditions. Now, if accepted, this approach would significantly limit the application of Chevron. Its deferential standard of review would apply only to the how questions of regulation, that is, those relating to the manner in which an agency exercises whatever regulatory authority a court would determine that it possesses. Now, the petitioner's underlying concern here is that agencies are fundamentally self-interested when it comes to questions regarding the scope of their own authority. Petitioner City of Arlington emphasizes in its brief the idea that if given deference at so-called Chevron Step Zero, agencies will invariably err on the side of giving themselves more rather than less power. Here, judicial deference to an agency's legal determination is, in the petitioner's view, tantamount to complicity in allowing the fox to guard the henhouse. This particular case in the petitioner's brief is also supported by a few points on the merits. Specifically, the petitioners point to the Savings Clause, Section 332C7A, and suggesting that because the statute says that nothing else other than what is in this paragraph shall, quote, limit or affect the authority of a state or local government, that that means that Congress has divested the FCC of jurisdiction to interpret these limitations or expound upon them. And secondly, they point to Section 332C7B5, which tells any person adversely affected by a final action or failure to act by a state or local government to go to court. The petitioners suggest that this merits-based argument divests the FCC of jurisdiction and specifies that courts and not the FCC should be determining what constitutes a reasonable period of time under Section 332C7. In response, the federal respondents, represented by Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, identify cases rebutting petitioners' pessimistic empirical view. That is, they point to cases in which agencies have interpreted organic statutes in a way that gives them less power rather than more. Other themes that emerge in the federal respondents' briefs are, first of all, the idea that the existing Chevron framework, which begins with the general question of whether Congress has delegated to the agency generally the authority to make rules carrying the force of law, is sufficient to keep agencies in check and to make sure that they're not exceeding the authority that Congress has delegated to them. This is also taken care of, in the respondents' view, by courts asking the question of whether the rule in question was promulgated in exercise of that general delegated authority. Another major theme in the federal respondents, both in terms of their briefs and also at oral argument, is pointing out the great mischief that would be done if we moved from this sort of holistic review of organic statutory authority and moved instead to a more provision-by-provision approach to establishing interpretive jurisdiction under the approach that is offered by the respondents. Now, the oral argument in this case was really sort of a joy, at least if you're an administrative law geek like I am. It was, however, a testament to Justice Scalia's oft-quoted observation that administrative law is not for sissies. The sophistication of all the participants at oral argument led to a lively discussion, however, that was sometimes easier to understand than the briefing. At the same time, and I'll remark a bit more on this later, it was remarkable that no clear test for determining what is jurisdictional and what is not jurisdictional emerged through this discussion. Now, a couple of points of clarification of the petitioner's case emerged at oral argument and warrant mentioning. First, when Mr. Goldstein was put on the spot by one of the justices to defend the IMLA's broad definition of jurisdiction, he ran away from it as fast as his legs could carry him. It was quite clear that the petitioners were really only arguing for a more narrow understanding of interpretive jurisdiction that was put forth in the briefing by the City of Arlington. Second, in response to a question from Justice Kennedy, Mr. Goldstein said that although an agency's determination of its own jurisdiction is not entitled to Chevron deference, it would be entitled to Skidmore deference. In other words, he said that a court should defer to it only to the extent that that case is persuasive. This is a bit like the respect that one circuit affords to the decisions of its sister circuits. Now, this seemed to strike the justices as very strange. Justice Scalia, in particular, asked why you would give an agency any deference at all if it had no jurisdiction with respect to the question at issue. A couple of notes about the government's performance at oral argument. First of all, Solicitor General Verrilli appeared to get the best traction when pointing to the potential confusion that would be wrought by adding an explicit provision-specific Step Zero to the familiar Chevron framework. Indeed, several of the justices seemed quite concerned that they would not be able to give the lower courts adequate guidance to fulfill this provision-specific Step Zero, and that it was very difficult to draw a clear and convincing line between these jurisdictional questions that no deference would be accorded to and the other statutory interpretation questions that are always dealt with at Step 1 of Chevron. Secondly, Solicitor General Varelli began his argument by agreeing that there is some threshold question of agency authority where no deference is due, where the court by itself makes a determination of whether the agency has authority. That is a point that generally everyone seemed to agree upon. The difficulty that the Solicitor General had was when pressed to identify the particular boundary between that threshold question of agency authority and other questions of agency authority that are always dealt with under the Chevron framework. Now, as a general matter, the justices seem generally skeptical about the petitioner's argument and very concerned about the workability of the proposed modification of Chevron's analytical framework. As I mentioned, it's emerged that everyone seemed to agree there was some threshold inquiry where no deference to the agency was appropriate or necessary. But it didn't seem that anyone could find precisely how you would identify that separate step. In general, it emerged that perhaps these concerns that the petitioners quite reasonably raise are dealt with in the existing Chevron framework at step one and by this sort of general view of courts to determine whether an agency has general authority to interpret the statute that's at issue. It was the provision-by-provision approach to Chevron Step Zero that seemed particularly unworkable, and identifying where the jurisdictional question ends and the statutory interpretation more generally begins just seemed impossible. Another point at oral argument was that everyone kept slipping into the merits discussion, even though the question presented was really just the more abstract question of Chevron deference. And these slips into the merits really didn't help the petitioners. First of all, the petitioners were trying to argue that the savings clause, that is Section 332C7A, suggests that the FCC is divested of authority to interpret Section 332C7 because it provides that nothing in this chapter shall limit or affect the authority of a state or local government over decisions regarding the placement of personal wireless service facilities. This argument didn't seem to gain as much traction as the petitioners might have hoped. In fact, it seemed that this clause was read less as a clear expression of congressional intent to divest the FCC of interpretive authority and more as a limitation on additional limits that could be placed on state or local authority, basically saying the only limits on state and local authority are the ones that are in this paragraph, and not saying that the FCC has no authority to determine precisely the limits of those limitations. Additionally, reasonable time in Section 332C7B2 seemed like the kind of ambiguous term that an agency would ordinarily be expected to interpret and that might need to be interpreted by reference to an agency's expert authority. Overall, these slips into the merits conveyed the impression that perhaps this case was a poor vehicle for the abstract Chevron Step Zero question. On the other hand, it seems that if it's not workable here, it is difficult to imagine a case in which Chevron Step Zero would both matter and still be workable. Indeed, there are plenty of cases in the past where the court has determined that an agency doesn't have the regulatory authority it claims, and it didn't require any Chevron Step Zero to get there. Now, my prediction for this case, and of course this is always a little bit difficult, but I think the general sense is that we shouldn't be expecting anything groundbreaking from the Supreme Court. It seemed like everyone was sort of on the same page in thinking that there is some room for a court to make these de novo determinations of the scope of agency authority, but that it wouldn't be workable to make that an explicit additional Chevron Step Zero part of the analytical framework, and that it shouldn't be done on a provision-by-provision basis. If anything, Congress has been legislating against the background of Chevron for years, and generally the idea that if it wants to deprive an agency of authority over a specific provision, it can and has done so, is the way that we should probably expect it to proceed in the future. On the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised if we get multiple opinions from the court, because while there generally seemed to be a consensus that the petitioners proposed Step Zero wouldn't be workable, the rationale for why it wouldn't be workable or why it doesn't fit in the framework didn't seem to be a matter of consensus. So I think it'll be an interesting case for all of us administrative law geeks. But on the other hand, I wouldn't expect anything really to change from the Chevron framework that's been in place since 1984.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.